One, two, three, four, five, six. My name is William Vincent Baumgartner.
And today's date?
Today is what, April 11th, the year 2001.
Okay, that seems to be working well. I don't care what direction we go, I'm interested, maybe just, how about briefly what you were doing before you came here?
Well, I came straight out of school. Got my degree on June the 13th, or the 11th, and I signed on the 15th.
Did you come here specifically from your degree? It made sense.
Yes, yeah. I had two job opportunities. One was DuPont back east, the other one was Hanford here with GE here. Didn't have enough money to get back east, so I took this one.
What was your degree?
Chemistry.
Oh, okay.
Which you would expect.
Would have been a lot of work here.
Right. When we came in, we were tech grads. There were 500 of us.
Did they, every year there were 500?
No, because they were stocking chemists for redox.
And what year was that?
1951.
Like fall or?
We came in June. And redox went online, I think, in 52 or 53. And so they were getting us prepared because you had, think about it, all of these were Q-cleared people. So it took several months. In my case, it took from June until the end of August, at which time we then went to T plant, and I was in T plant from August of 51 until November of 52. And at that time, we had a lot of changes, a lot of new supervision. You know, supervisors were changing because B plant was shutting down. Or shut down, and so we were picking up those supervisors, plus all the new chemists that were wandering through. So there was, in the original from 1945 until at that time, there was only one shift chemist, and we had four shifts, you know, A, B, C, D shift, which means we were working 7 days a week around the clock. The plant never shut down. Didn't even shut down for holidays. Okay.
But you were working normal 8-hour days?
Normal 8-hour days, 5 days a week. And so you'd work swing days in graveyard.
Yeah, and they rotated them rather quickly, right?
Well, it'd be like seven graveyards. And
7 weeks or seven?
No, 7 days. Every 28 day was a cycle.
I think they've changed that since then.
Well, no, it depends. They might be working 10-hour shifts. So we don't have anything now operating, quote unquote, that needs to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. At that time, no one wanted to shut the plants down. We were going into, at that time, the Cold War, and things were getting really sticky because we knew that the Russians had the weapon, and they were making lots of them. So we were just in the process of making more and better than anybody else.
So when you arrived, things were gearing up?
We were gearing up for redox. B plant shut down. T plant was going to shut down as soon as redox got going, because redox was built to handle not only all of the material that our reactors could produce, but what Savannah River could produce. It was that big a plant.
Were they going to ship stuff out here?
They did. They actually did. Our material that we made here had what was called the lowest MWD material, megawatt days per ton. That was a unit of measurement. Our plutonium was what we call 500 megawatt days per ton. Savannah River reactors were quite large, and they couldn't give us any material that had less than 1,000 megawatt days per ton. And so we had to end up blending to ours in order to get a weapon that... what do you know about plutonium?
You know, more than the general lay person.
Okay. Plutonium, as it comes from the reactor, what you really want is plutonium-239, and you don't want 240 and 241. The higher the MWD, the more 240 and 241 is in the plutonium, which is not a weapon.
And it ends up in your finished product.
Right. You can't separate that out easy. you just can't, not with what we've got. That's a plutonium, and we use a chemical reaction to get the plutonium separated from everything. And so,
so the 1,000 megawatt day would have more?
240 and 241. Okay. And that's not a good weapon material. So we blended it with our 500, and basically you're saying, all right, we got 750 megawatt days per ton, which was our weapons. And the material that we got from the reactors would sit out in the reactor in the basins or in 200 Arth area basin for at least 60 days for cooling off. So that a lot of the short half-life materials were gone. And then we would bring it into T plant in a cask, 1,500 pounds of metal, dissolve that up, separate the plutonium out of that at T plant, using a bismuth phosphate precipitator, co-precipitator, in the front end of the canyon. And then we were transferred over to 224, and then we'd use a lanthanum. Lanthanum brings down more plutonium for less. The precipitation is such that there's more plutonium per pound on the precipitate than there is with bismuth. But bismuth doesn't bring down fission products and uranium, whereas lanthanum would have a tendency to bring out some of these other things. Give you a little insight. At the time when we were running this, we were literally using up all the bismuth that was being mined in America. Does that tell you? So it was a, in other words, we were using a lot of bismuth.
And throwing it out each batch.
That was all going into the waste tanks. Okay. Every bit of that's in that waste tank. Some of these days we'll mine that.
Yeah.
You know, because it's, anyway, T plant then, the canyon building had the bismuth extract from the dissolver to, and the volume, the final volume with the plutonium was, I think, something on it. If you can get a hold of the C manual.
I've got it.
Have you? It's a very large book.
Yeah.
That will tell you chemically everything you need to know. That was classified TS at 1950. Only a few people got a chance to read that. I was one of them.
When you came here, did they sit you down with something like that? Or?
Well, I was in a very interesting position. When I went to T plant, the laboratory, 222T, my first assignment, now we had three chemists instead of one, so my first assignment was to go to 271T laboratory, which was a cold laboratory, what we quote unquote cold. In other words, we weren't handling any of the reactor materials. This was cold solutions that we were using to make these strikes, you know, as we were going up the process. There were like six solutions that we had to make up for this process. Recognize the C manual was written from test tube chemistry to this 1,800 foot long canyon building. And so in the early days when they got to operating, they didn't hesitate to make two or three bismuth strikes to get all the plutonium out, because they wanted the plutonium. But as time went on, making multi-strikes when a single strike should work is what they were going for. And when I got there, they were averaging three strikes to get all the plutonium out of a batch.
Another word for strike is
where you precipitate down with bismuth.
Yeah.
And you ended up having to use three times before you could get all the plutonium out. Okay, then I went into the 271T laboratory where we did the cold chemistry, read the C manual, and it turns out that in the C manual, if you look at it very carefully, the variance on the chemicals that you could use, when it said six normal, it didn't mean 4.5 or 5, it meant say like 5.8 to 6.2. Well, what was happening is that we weren't quite as careful. Our laboratory had gotten dirty over the years, and so we were walking outside the limits. Even though we were saying it was 6.0, it really wasn't. For a lot of reasons. One is dirty tools, dirty laboratory, and the other is our standards weren't good, weren't as good as they could have been. Okay, I got in there and I got that dubious job of trying to figure out how we can get it so we can get down to one. And we did that. It took me about a month. And we cleaned up all the chemical, all the glassware, went down and got a brand new set of calibrations that was really very fine. It had to meet the specifications. And then when that happened, we went down to a single strike. And we were able to get the plutonium out. When that happened, operations then glommed onto me and says, huh, we ain't taking any more chances with this. This guy's going to do that all the time. So I ended up making solutions for about 3 or 4 months.
You're talking about major gallons of solution?
Yes. Yeah.
The
cold chemicals that were used, right. And they have to be made up to specification. And yeah, we made like 500 gallons at a crack type of thing. Ferrous sulfate, we only made like 50 gallons and we used 50 gallons. That was not something that you could leave hanging around, which they did. And then therefore the ferrous sulfate solution wasn't as strong as it should have been. Even though yesterday or the day before we measured it was like, say, so much normality, and it turns out the next day if you leave it sit in a stainless steel vat, it's going to be a lot less. That was part of the problem. So, and we got that cleaned up, and when we did, then they decided, oh golly, we're now one strike per run. Well, let's see if we can't make a run, a real, just see how much this plant could really have produced. And they never had. In the earlier days, you know, when they only had F, H, and D in the very early days, the reactors. See, then the ER came on, and B plant, you know, F, B, and C plant, and then the two, when they, you know, as they got more and more than these B and T plant, they didn't have to be efficient because they had enough capability to process it all. However, when they were going to go to redox, they just wanted to see what the plant could really do. And it turned out they could do a lot more than they had thought.
What was the turnaround time when you got there generally for when they dumped the fuel into the dissolver until it was...
I don't know. Is that declassified yet? In other words, each run was equivalent to a half a piece.
When you say run, you're assuming 1,500
grams. 1,500 grams of plutonium.
From 1,500 tons.
From 1,500 pounds.
Ton and a half. Okay.
Well, about a ton. I don't know about the halves. About a ton of metal. Depended on the
metric tons or English tons.
I'm not.
Yeah.
Yep, to look in the C manual will tell you.
Go back and forth even in there.
I thought the C manual will say 1,500 pounds in a batch.
Sounds right to me.
And so it wasn't quite a ton. It was about 3/4 of a ton. Anyway, that's... Look at the C manual, it'll tell you. And you know, for the specific amount.
From the time that you put it in until it was heading out of the 200 area, or let's say...
Out of the back end of T plant before it went down to 231, 2345 building. It would, when I first got there, it would take about a day, three shifts.
Okay.
When we did our master run, it didn't take a shift.
When you fine-tuned it and got it down to one precipitation.
Right.
So that's like, we'll call it 8 hours.
About 10 hours is what it was actually. Okay. Boy, that was a lot of stuff. So the old plants could have produced a lot. We wouldn't have needed redox, but redox had just had so much capability. And then redox had its problems. It wasn't very long when we found out what its problem was, because the hexone got nitrated.
And no chemist had predicted that?
No, they hadn't. They didn't think that trinitro hexone was going to do what TNT does, but it did. And so we had some pops in some of the vessels. And so when that happened, well, then we went to Purex.
When you were at T plant, basically they had fine-tuned the process over those years.
No.
Not to what you really could have done.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. They were willing to take basically one run per day.
and that was taken care of.
That was taking care of everything needed, which they knew that wouldn't be the future, mm-hmm. but it was enough to satisfy the military needs. You know, when you had B&T, so that basically gave you a weapon a day.
So you were spending most of your time in a lab and not a hot lab?
Yeah, well, I lasted there 2 months up in the cold lab. Then they said, well, Bill, you've got to come on down to the hot lab. We can't let you stay up there forever. So what we did then is we moved the cold lab over to 222T so I could do the hot work and the cold work.
Oh, they put both together?
Yeah, well, we cleaned off one side. And we put all the coal chemicals in there, so they then brought all the samples over to the T, you know, 222T, and then I, at the same time, got the chance then to do the hot stuff. And it turned out that the two things that I ended up doing, I had an educated thumb, because everything is pipetting.
Right.
Okay, and the final solution was based on 5 lambda. So you weren't allowed to go very much over the mark and just exactly to the mark. And then you had to make double dilutions. So you were making some very interesting high dilutions in order for the counter to count. And you had to be within a fairly narrow. And we were having a hard time without reruns running the final solution, you know, that went down to 231, just to get the right count for the countability. Because that was the first accountability.
How many
had.
Samples would you do of one batch as it went through? That's what you're talking about now?
Yeah, one sample. Well, you had many samples from the batch because you'd have like the dissolver solution and then you'd have the first strike and then you'd have the first strike waste because you...
What would you test in the dissolver? I mean, wasn't that just dissolve it, move it on, and that's it?
No, dissolver solution was where we tried to get the first guess at how much plutonium was in the metal. Because see,
yep. Okay.
And so that when you got it at the back end of the process, it had a better match.
Back up one step farther. The people at the reactors had estimates of what should be in but based on the number of hours in the reactor.
Yeah, but it depended on where in the reactor
right.
it was.
How close was that? And when you guys did the first test in the dissolver, that was your first chemical analysis.
Were
they usually close to estimates? Did you argue with the reactor guys about what was in there?
All the time.
Oh.
All the time.
In what way?
Well, when you'd get 1,100 grams instead of 1,500 grams.
At the end.
Or when you'd get another dissolver, what happened to the other 400 grams? You know, did we lose it? I see, then you'd, when the discrepancy was too large, then you had to rerun everything. Got to go back and get another sample of the dissolver solution and see what the hell. And then if it matched what you took the first. Because remember now, sampling is a real art.
Yeah.
These guys had some, you know, you're only taking 2 drops. And that's got to be representative of what's in there.
That and how many gallons, right?
Like 500 gallons. So you right off the bat, you've got an interesting problem. And at that time, not too much was statistics known. We hit arbitrary limits, and they were as arbitrary as they thought we could meet them based on the laboratory. You know, having a test tube type technology versus 500 gallons is a whole different world. And so we were having our sweats, so that when you fell out of the limits, and that should be in the C manual, those numbers. I know what they are, but I'm not sure if it's always... If it's in the C manual, you can publish it real easy. I hate to give you information that I'm not absolutely sure
right.
has been released.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, the specifics are less important than the generality.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
They always are better than just to get a general idea of what it was. Here's a couple of things from the tech manual. Here's a dissolver flow sheet.
Okay.
Sort of the checklist, the log, no, well, the recipe.
Yeah. 8 buckets of 105 each. Add 3,800 gallons of sodium nitrate dissolver. 3 to 5 hours at 4.5. Okay. Heat dissolver to boiling and add 1,100 pounds of sodium hydroxide, digest for 2 hours. Okay, they've released everything. All right, good, 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 good. So large quantity, these dissolvers are big, big deals. So the original solution comes in, it's, you know, like 5,100, you know, here's 5,100 pounds, okay? That's 5,300 gallons, 500 gallons, basically. Okay, when it comes off the back end with plutonium, it's about 15 gallons. When it comes off the back end of 224, it's about 5 gallons. When it comes off the back end of 231, it was a liter and a half. And when it comes off the back end of 2345, it's a piece of metal. Okay, so that, okay, we're 5,000 pounds, the general, yes, and the solutions are large. You know, you.
And how much was in a sample that came into the hot lab?
Two drops.
Two which?
Two drops.
That was so radioactive they had to put it in shielding.
Yes, three inches.
How could two drops be so radioactive you have to put it in shielding? To a layperson that doesn't sound like much.
That's true. It was called a doorstop, and in it was a bayonet point, and in there was just two drops.
And you didn't just pull out the test tube?
Hell no, we didn't. We had a tool that went into the doorstop, grabbed our 25 lambda sample.
What's a lambda?
Lambda is a thousandth of a cc.
Okay. so it was how many of those?
25, that's 0.025 cc's. Okay. And I don't even remember what two drops is anymore, but I can tell you right now, it ain't a hell of a lot. Because if you reran a doorstop three times, you were out of solution. So it's about 100 lambda.
You could run it three times?
Yeah. Okay. You could run it three times, then you had to take a new solution. We never went past two, but you could run up to three.
Okay.
If you couldn't get them to match with, if you couldn't get the, you know, the two of them to match, because one operator would be one and another operator would run the other one. So you had two guys running the doorstop, and they had to match within a given value. And if they did, then you went on. That became God's law about what the plutonium concentration was.
You were looking for plutonium in two drops out of 500 gallons.
Yes.
And that, what you were looking for is the percentage of plutonium.
You wanted to come up with a number like, say, 1,500 grams of what's in that tank. If it was outside of specifications and you didn't grab that out of the C-manager, but there was a limit, 1,500 grams plus or minus 100 grams, for instance, as a case in point. So that if you got 1,350 and your two guys got 1,350, then they had to go back and resample because it's supposed to be between 1,400 and 1,600 grams. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So now they resample. If the second sample now agreed with the first one, then that's what became, then they says, aha, there's not 1,500 grams in there, you know, whatever the number was.
How close would it have to be before you called it a green?
What?
If the first guy came up with 1,500, how close could the second one be?
It had to be within 50. We were allowed to have, the two had to be within 50 of 1,500 grams.
Okay. And back it up one more step. You would then take your number, let's say you get an accurate number, and you say, but the reactor guys are saying, 1,800.
All right. If it was supposed to be 1,800 and we say got 1,500, then we had to go back and resample.
Okay.
Because it could be the two drops we got wasn't quite representative of the solution. So we got another one. If those two agreed within, say, 100, then we said that's what the number is. However, if two of them did not agree, within 100, within say 100 grams, then we got a third sample,
right.
And two out of three.
Now, if yours are agreeing, but they're different from what the reactor guys estimated,
then this is what we took.
You took your numbers and said, "We'll talk."
That's where we go.
Yeah.
And so that when we got out to the back end of 271T, the last solution out of there, then that had to check. In other words, we couldn't.
Right.
And if it did check, fine. And if it didn't check, see, then we had to go back. Do the resampling, because see there, you weren't using a bayonet, you weren't using a doorstop.
Hadn't you already lost all the when after you do the precipitation.
Oh, you leave them in the tanks.
You leave them in the tank until you're all done, and then you'd send it to the waste.
Right.
Okay.
See, that's what I'm saying. You leave solutions, they sit there. These solutions, they just sat there until the run got accepted. When the run got accepted, then you could just pump the stuff to the tank farms.
Okay.
Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, you've got everything here.
Yeah.
You've got everything here that you need.
It's enough to give a good idea of how things ran.
Right, right.
And
these percentages had to be right because they were now recalculated in terms of what the solution had to be that we're going to be adding, you know, like 6% or whatever the percentage was. And it wasn't allowed to deviate very far.
You're saying based on the amount of plutonium that was in the solution?
No, based on this. We did, it's the amount of metal you dissolve.
It's what?
It was the amount of metal you dissolve. We always dissolved, we always dissolve the same amount of metal.
It was the batch size, not whatever, however much plutonium.
Right, that's what regulated the amount of chemicals you put in.
Well, you could have used less bismuth if there was less plutonium in the batch, theoretically.
Not really.
No?
Bismuth, when we got our fine-tuned, yeah. But see, we were expecting them to put slugs in there that gave us the 1,500 grams. We weren't expecting 1,800 or down to 11. We were expecting 1,500 grams. And we expected them to blend those slugs. They knew where they were at.
Right.
And they knew where they had come from.
So that should add up.
It should have added up.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing was, you know, we didn't fuss much. That didn't bother us a lot. Maybe one run out of 10. Deviated from what we expected to. The rest of the time, these guys were pretty good. They knew that reactor pretty well, and they pretty well knew that in this pile there was, especially after we got the computer working pretty well. That took some doing, but once they got the computer program that told them what they needed, when to push, and see, they would push not the whole reactor, so they'd just push a certain section.
The tubes of their choice.
Right, right. And that was based on what the computer said was there, based on what they saw in the profile of the number of neutrons per centimeter squared. When all that happened and that computer program was working, I was very fortunate. I happened to know the guy that wrote the dang thing. And we were taking a class together because at the time, programming was pretty much at the beginning stages. And the language you were using was your own. And the arithmetic was really, that's where we were having all of our problems. The arithmetic was such that getting 5 or 6 digits of precision was pretty hard. And so we were looking for better ways of getting 6 or 7, 8 digits of precision without taking a large amount of time on the computer. Because you remember now, the computer in those days was like 37 milliseconds per cycle. So you weren't getting very many cycles per second like you are now where we got 700 megahertz.
37 milliseconds is 30 cycles per second, give or take.
No, it's
300,
yeah.
Okay, now they're
billions
and billions.
Yeah, 900 million in my home. In my home one I got is 333, and that's about 3-4 years old. So you get what I'm trying to say? The computers were small. They were only like maybe 6 kilo.
Mm-hmm.
kilo. And 30. So we were looking for methods, and the reactor kind of thing was really burning computer time.
Just calculating when the slugs are ready.
Right, when they're ready to push out. So we were taking inordinate large amount of time. So the guy worked on that problem, and we took him out.
Do you remember what department he would have been in to be doing that?
He'd been in the 100 area.
Okay.
He'd been in operations.
With their own people.
Yeah, it was his own, and there weren't too many computer people at that time. You know, there was. I think there's like 10 guys that
were
I knew.
Many reactor operators.
Well, the reactor operators are just pushers of buttons and switches, you know. But nuclear engineers? We were teaching the guys nuclear engineering here. I took classes on that.
And realizing, too, that this idea of estimating when the slugs are ready, and then finding out that you were correct.
Right.
They had to do it.
Well, they had to make a whole bunch of experiments and all that kind of stuff. And it took a while. Anyway, that's a precursor to this. At the time when it, like I say, it was all trying to push metal through, and so we had limits, and if we deviated from the limits, then we did a resampling, and then if the samples were close, then we went ahead and continued, got the final one. If it checked the front end within a certain limit, then we, in other words, we had that, we figured at least 90%, 90 to 95% recovery.
And you were happy?
Well, when I first got there, we were happy with that. When we got done, we were not happy until we got 99. Because then that leaves only a little bit of plutonium in the waste solutions.
Were there any problems you remember overcoming that made a noticeable difference that they hadn't seen before, or hadn't been able to correct, or hadn't realized it was there?
I don't know. There was an awful lot of chemical engineers in T plant. I think each shift had like four.
They'd been working on it for years.
Yeah, right from the beginning. And they were as dumbfounded as everybody else was, because not realizing some of these problems. It happened to be that my forte was analytical chemistry. And I had 3 years of the damn stuff. When I went to Seattle University, let me give you my college. Freshman year was Yakima Valley College. So I took beginning chemistry. Sophomore year, I went to Seattle University. I then took analytical chemistry. In my junior year, I came back to Yakima Valley. I got a ruptured appendicitis. And junior year, I was back at Yakima Valley College, because it cost me my whole years of college money. And I took organic. My senior year, I ended up having to take PCAM, organic, since I had taken it in Yakima Valley. I had to take organic qual. And since they didn't like what I had done, I had to take advanced analytical chemistry and advanced organic for my senior year. So I was taking like 10 hours every quarter chemistry classes. So I got 30 hours my senior year alone. So I had an extra year basically of chemistry just to get my degree. And so I ended up having the kind of thing that they wanted here. Somewhat, because one of the solutions was semi-organic.
What kind of automated instruments, electronic instruments, were you using back in college? Was it all test tubes and...
Most of the stuff that I did in college was in terms of gravimetric. Here, it was volumetric. Volumetric was what we called elementary. It was more prone to error. And so that's what I was getting at. Volumetric analysis is more prone to error. 50 lambda in 10 milliliters, 25 lambda out of that. So you have to make sure everything is stirred, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So volumetric lends itself to some really interesting errors. Whereas gravimetric errors, we would have precipitated it, put it onto, pulled it out on a filter paper, weighed the filter paper before and after, would have been much tighter tolerance.
Two drops?
Yeah, because filter paper...
back at Berkeley, when they discovered plutonium, those are the amounts they were working
and
with.
They
tiny,
were,
tiny, tiny amounts.
Yeah, they were with a fraction of a gram.
Yeah, okay.
So and that was the total amount. And now you're going to sample that to count it to see how much it was really there.
The beauty of chemistry is you can do it on big levels or small levels. The equations are the same. It's just that the instrumentation and the beakers are different sizes.
Well, also too, in gravimetric, if you weigh, say, a 5 gram sample, and you have down to the closest tenth of a milligram on possible with a beam balance, you can do that. So that gives me like three orders of magnitude. So a little bit of weight goes a long way. Secondly, you're adding some weight to the precipitate by putting some more atoms to the molecule in which you're precipitating, so therefore you're putting more weight to it, so it's not less, it's more. Mm-hmm. And so there, and you correct for it. But the point I'm getting at is that you make sure that your gravimetric analysis will allow you at least 99%. So that if you say you can go to a closest tenth of a milligram, you would expect to have at least 10 grams difference in weight. And so you, in our case, we would process something on the order of 50 milligrams. See, that would be 500. So that we should have been able to hit 1% easy with a gravimetric analysis. Whereas with volumetric analysis, now you're going to titrate. And you have to know, when I first got there, they gave me the calibrated solutions to two digits.
As opposed to what would you have expected?
I would have expected four. Okay. With four, I can do something with it.
Yeah.
I can't do much precision analysis with two. Because now all of a sudden, the third digit is half. You know, so now I've got, suppose it's six normal, and I've got five, it's almost a percent. And so I got nasty when I went down the standards analysis. I got to have minimum of three digits. I prefer four. And that was very hard for them to give me. So they gave me basically about 3.5 on the volume. But that made the difference. That's why we ended up getting precisely where we were. It was little things like this that people weren't watching. Yeah, if it was really and truly, you know, six normal, you know, plus or minus 0.1 normal, everything was fine. But what happens when it isn't? You know, then yeah, we ended up striking twice, three times, that kind of thing. Anyway, with me getting the advantage of working with these guys in the cold part, I also was allowed to drive. To drive the elevator in order to train.
Yeah.
I got to do that, moving the cell block.
Based on what?
Well, they began to know me.
Okay.
So I says, well, why don't I sit in with you, see what you're doing?
Okay.
I says, how can I help if I don't know what anybody's doing? You know, a chemist can do more than just chemistry if he can watch what people are doing, see what kind of system. Are the cells really as the C manual says they are? You know, big, herky stainless steel tanks. In other words, how much volume is sitting between this tank and that tank? You know, pipes 2 inches in diameter is 8 feet long. Well, there's some volume there. It's little things like this that they had overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
That when I saw the equipment, that I said, oh, that makes sense to me. And then we were dropping through a solutions down through a sort of a rig, you know, a valve, you know, so this could go into this one, this valve would let it go into that one. So it was there was all those kinds of things. So there was solutions sitting there. Get what I'm trying to say? From the tank where we knew what it was until it ran out the spout down in the wherever it was going. Well, there was a volume in there. Okay, if that thing sits there for any length of time, it's not going to be the same. It's just little things like this that when I saw, you know, even though I read it in the manual, but it doesn't give you these volumes. So you couldn't strike a tank with 10 gallons and you had 10 gallons in the pipe.
You wouldn't be using the fresh solution.
Right, and you ended up having problems. And this was all part of the problem. So then I went to these volumes, you know, and how much was being added. And we then played around a little bit, and we strengthened a couple of them, went to 6.3 instead of 6.0 to make up for what was decaying in the pipery. And when we did that, see, that's how we ended up really fine-tuning one strike, really could shove it through there. It was little things like that that hadn't been considered when from the chemistry in the laboratory to the big plant. Those are the kinds of things that we discovered on the job. Chemical engineers were looking at this thing in a massive. I was looking at it in terms of chemistry and how much volumes were involved and what my normalities had to be and all, you know.
Who would have been the person at T plant who knew what the current settings were? Like, it wasn't a railroad, it was a chemistry system with pipes. Who would have the map that shows where how everything is connected?
The maps were what we call on the pipe row. In other words, here sits the tanks, then we got a big wall, 12-foot concrete wall, and on the other side, you have these boards, like the 6-3 board, which was the 6-3 tank. And he had, in other words, he could push valves like Valve, which would then allow solution A to drop in B, C, D, E, and they knew, you know, I'm gonna add this solution, that's Valve C. So he'd open up Valve C, and the amount of volume that was up there was the specified volume. You know, that was dropped down in there. And they would let it 5 minutes, and we all run down in there, and then they close the valve. Yeah, that thing. And these are boards. And each section, like six had a board, seven had a board, eight had a board, up to 13. Each one had a board. And each had a group of valves, had a group of valves for whatever they were going to do, whether they were exit, import, you know, the openings, exit, import, adding solutions and all that kind of. And then, you know, so there would be maybe 8 to 10 switches, you know, for them to open and close that they would do. And there'd be an operator in front of each one of those, every shift. And then there would be two what I call chemical engineers following. And they had a logbook when they did what and for how long. Open at such and such a time, close at such and such a time. That was all part of the record.
There's a couple in there that are like that, the log pages, where you'd actually fill in what happened.
Right.
What we're supposed to do, here's the time we started.
Right. And that all got put in there. And the chemical engineer picked those up. He then scanned them. He went over them, to make sure everything was copacetic against whatever rules. So they had a set of rules that, say, like 5 minutes. So they didn't expect anything between 4.5 to 5.5 minutes. So he expected a time to be like that. Sometimes an operator would be out maybe smoking a cigarette. God only knows, you know, because not everybody was conscious totally at the time. You know, we're human beings. So that was the operations part. I knew all that because I had been down there to see what they were all doing. This is how I recognized that there was heels. Same way with exporting. The pipe that went into the tank didn't drain every drop. That sounds elementary, but now you have to find out, you know, when they build a tank, it turns out that each tank, though there might be three tanks identical, they would have different heels.
Describe what a heel is.
Heel is leftover solution. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound like much, but it turns out that suppose you dissolve up something, but not everything stays in solution. Suppose you get particulates left over. Yeah. That's, you know, it's all possible, especially when you're making the precipitate, you know, and it's falling down. Now when you, you know, pull that precipitate out and go to the next tank, did you get it all? See, how much would it have stayed in the heel? So those are the. Now, the chemical engineers worried about that. Now, how do you quantify that?
Can't go in and look.
No, heck no. So we developed some sample analysis. We were over in the laboratory with them. We worked together, hand in glove, and we sat there. And I got involved in a lot of that kind of thing just because of the analytical chemistry that I'd had. Not everybody that came out with a BS in chemistry had all the chemistry that I had. And that was, anyway, that was fine with me. I enjoyed my time there. And I knew the operating people. I was on C, A, and D shifts. So I got to meet different people. Like if you were on C shift, you only met those operators on C shift. But
you didn't change with the same shift all the time.
You always stayed with the same shift, generally.
So you were with the same operators?
Same operators all the time when you were on C shift.
Yes.
But I was very fortunate where I got bumped from C shift to A shift to D shift. So I got to meet not only C people, but I got to meet D and A people. And it makes a difference because you can pretty soon, like a technician, you can tell which ones are the good ones, that type of thing. And that made a difference, made a difference. Anyway, I think I've answered all.
How about, you mentioned you got to ride in the crane.
Yep.
Could you describe... How tedious was it? Describe what it must have been like for the crane operator.
Oh, it's a single lens. no depth perception. So what they did is they would shine light so there would be shadows. So, you know, because to pick up a block, for instance, was a metal frame, you know, that came like that. And he had to put a hook into there so he could lift her up. Well, with no depth perception, where in the hell is the hook? You know, might be over here. Might,
and he could only look down. He couldn't look from the side.
No. And only one eye. Only one single eye. Through a whole bunch of going down. Because, you know, he couldn't look straight down because we were on the side.
You're right.
You know, we were on the side. So you're going over a barrier looking down. And you couldn't. Then the blocks were all numbered and all that kind of stuff. Like, you'd have 6-3, ABC, you know, that A comes first, and then, you know, and so that you put the three blocks back onto the cell the same way each time. Because they were not identical pieces.
Right. When you took the lids off and looked down, there might be a mass of equipment and pipes. What would the operator, the crane operator, how would he know which one to take off first? What was that called?
Jump, now you get down.
His instructions. You know, did he have a sheet of things he was supposed to
the do? Chemical engineer told him that maybe I wanted. Now, each pipe had a little thing for him to put the hook on. And we had the big hook for the blocks. And then we had a little hook for when we wanted to do repair work. For instance, you want to take off a small piece of pipe. Okay, he had to go, first of all, he had an impact wrench. But you had to sit down on that baby and get onto that nut. Undo it. Might be four to on one's end, four on the other end, pull that pipe out. Put another one in its place. He had to do that all with one eye, no depth perception. So it was all in how the guy wanted the light set so that there would be shadows. So he would know when the hook was, you know, how do you know when the hook gets in there and
did
picks
it? Did
he
have the lights on the crane that he would adjust?
No, they were up too high.
So what lights were they?
When they opened a cell, they had like on a rack, you know, and they have lights shining down. You know, it didn't matter that got irradiated.
Right.
You know, so and we, for instance, if here was a cell, we would move all the blocks from 6-3 over to 7. You know, okay. So on this end, on each end, you could have lights. Or you'd have two on one side, so you, whatever the guy specified, the crane operator. And they learned that from scratch. They had four of the best crane operators you're ever going to find, because doing that job with one eye is my when I couldn't. It takes a lot more finesse than you think.
And patience.
And these guys are very quick. Pull the tank out. So it's it was to me the most skilled individual was a crane operator, and they were very good. I can remember him taking all the three blocks off a cell in less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
I can remember him taking off two pipes, you know, bringing her impact wrench down, putting it onto the nuts, four on each end, that's 8 bolts. And it was highly magnetized so that bolt stuck, you know, at the impact wrench. Then he had them pulled over and somebody had to, you know, he had to undo it. I don't know how that impact wrench was built, but it allowed him to put the bolt someplace. I think they put him into a little thing so where he could go back down and grab a hole, you know, it was set down into a block, you know, with a hole where the bolt then fit down into the hole with the head on top, and then he would drop it off, and he go grab the next one. When he had all 8, he could see all 8, and then I got them all off. It's little things, you know, that you don't. He says, "Well, I got to take off 8 bolts," so he wanted to make sure he had them all off. And I can remember we took out a 6-3 tank one time, the dissolver solution tank, took one day. There was like 4 pipes to take off, pull the tank out, put it onto the railroad car, you know, 6 railroad cars away. Because the dissolver tank had sludge in the bottom, hotter than hell.
Yeah.
And then that went to the burial ground. And the new tank had been sitting there, and he went and picked it up, put it down in there. And that had to be oriented to, so that it just sat only one way, so that all these hangers just fit perfectly. Because you're talking about hangers, you know, pipes that go to the wall, you know, where the guy is opening and closing and all that type of thing. And he did that in one day.
And there could be no workers anywhere near that?
Not in the canyon.
Yeah.
Once you pulled off the cell blocks, now on up to 11, no one on the high end, up to cell 11, from 6 to cell 11, I guess there was a cell 5. But anyway, when those blocks were off, no one was in the canyon. But I think if you had 12 and 13, you could have someone in the canyon, because there wasn't enough stuff up there anymore to make any difference. I don't know if you got pictures of that. Oh, here we go. Okay. Well, I never saw a... There's 20 cells, I see. But I don't ever... Yeah, but I never saw us ever go past 13, so I'm assuming that. Now, the waste from 224 building came back, that was recycled. You know, take my word for that.
When you say recycled?
Ran through another run, was added to a solution, and up here at about 10 and 11, tank 10 and 11, they would add it back into there. It wouldn't be very much.
Oh, you mean the waste?
The waste from 224.
From their finished process, whatever was left would have a tiny amount.
Yeah, whatever it had in there, they recycled it and ran it in. Even though we didn't think, but we made sure there was no plutonium. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Here we go. Here's a nice picture of it. Here you can see where the crane operator was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Pipe gallery and operator gallery. See, this is where these guys were. And then the pipe gallery is where solutions were running. God, that was a mess. Because, you know, you make the solutions were in 271, where the crane operator got into the cab. He would get into the cab the front end here. He got into the cab in the front end, and then, you know, and that's where we made up the solutions. Where where he got in. This is how I got to know the guy, because the guy had to walk by the laboratory, and then the tank solutions that we were making up were right there, and there was just a hallway to his crane. So he couldn't, I don't remember, the longest I ever saw a guy in there was 4 hours.
Yeah.
But most of the time, the guy couldn't handle much more than about 2 hours, and he had to have about a 30-minute break, because that was just, you know, unless he could use both eyes, but I don't remember anybody ever using two eyes.
When there's a batch ready to go, anybody who was holding it up would be under a lot of pressure, whether it was the chemist or the crane operator who had a chore to do. How did that make your daily routine? Was it pretty pressured?
For me, no, we didn't. For us in the laboratory, that was not the case. The only time we ever held anybody up is if we ran out of a solution.
For the cold solution.
And then they got pissed.
Yeah.
You're right. And that only happened not very often. You know, that would be an error on the part of the chemical engineer.
He didn't order enough.
He didn't make the tank, you know, they ran too much solution through, you know. When we got into the final run, that happened to us a couple of times where the guy made up 500 gallons and we used 500 gallons before I made up, because there were two tanks in each one. Each one, you know, you've got this one running and you're making this one up. And you're trying to make it up as close to the using, finishing off the using, so that you didn't make too many, because some of these are oxidant reduction solutions, and they age poorly. they lose their strength.
What? How many hours or days?
Ferrous sulfate solution, probably in 3 or 4 days, would lose 50%.
Oh, okay.
That kind of problem. So you didn't want to make up a ferrous sulfate solution except maybe just a few hours before you started using it. It was the best. Then it was the closest. I worked out a table for them to, because they would change the amount of volume as it got older. I would give them the moment when it got when we knew what it was, and then as it aged, then we'd say, well, okay, it's 6.3, and then 2 hours later it was 6.2, and that kind of thing. So they would know how much more. Maybe you would add an extra gallon or two or three of that solution just to make sure it would work, you know.
What about the hot lab, though? If they were under pressure to get their numbers done?
That was, the sooner the better, because you couldn't go from 6.3 to 7 or to 8 until you had the answer verified. So when these operators came in and took those samples, and they had to bring them over, and then we got right on them. If we screwed around more than an hour and a half, by the time they got the answer, they were ticked.
Okay.
Because, see, that means that tank was sitting there, it couldn't move.
So you always did a test up at the solver to get a first number?
Always.
Okay.
And we did a test on every day. 7, 8, 9, 10, hey.
And each of those took about an hour?
Hour and a half.
So that's a good hunk of the batch time right there.
Well,
they were processing. Yeah.
See, as soon as they got the 6.3 out, then they could put another dissolver in there.
Right.
So that they could have, you know, there might be three runs going through the canyon.
And if your numbers didn't match, and you say we have to do another test or take another sample, then you're starting to hold things up.
Then's when, yeah, right.
And if you literally had to go get another sample, how long would it take?
Operators had to go back into the canyon. Had to go back in these little doors, go into where the sample, there was a little sample room area where they'd have the door stop and they would do their little thing of agitating solution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and dropping in the two drops, you know, sucking it up about three times into that little drop, sucking it off and doing it about three times to get the right sample size. I watched that operation too. That was they weren't stirring it enough to start with.
Getting a sample, didn't some of the cells have a little inset box where they would get the samples at the cell?
No, they were all gotten over here.
In the operating gallery?
No, in the operating, on the other side. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the canyon building, on these little doors that you see right here,
right.
That allowed them to go into a little room and they could sample three cells.
Hmm.
Each one allowed them to sample three cells. So they could, in other words, this one could sample these three cells, and then they overlapped, except for the middle one. But they overlapped on one, so that if you didn't like the answer from that one, you could go maybe in the next bay and sample it from the other sampler. You know, you had the only one you couldn't was the middle one.
Would they enter then from that side?
They would enter from this side, and it was just a small room. It's a small room. And see, these pipes went into the tank, you know, they dropped into the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a little pipe, you know, and they'd stir around fresh solution. And then you didn't take that out of the C manual. It tells you, they told them how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You got a perfect picture. It's complicated.
Yeah.
See here? All you had to do to take off this one is go down and hit that thing with the impact wrench straight down. Yep, here it is.
Yeah.
You can get a pretty good feel as to what it was doing.
And did they have a map or a chart that would say what's connected to what?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The engineer says, you go in and you go to the fourth valve. So the guy had to go down and read 1, 2, 3, go and pull that one off.
Would they ever hook it up to the wrong one?
Not easy.
Yeah.
Because they were all made with different lengths.
Yeah.
And different lengths. You couldn't put this particular hanger on any place but here. So you might get it on here and it wouldn't fit. It wouldn't fit It wouldn't fit properly.
And if they were replacing a jumper or needed a new one...
Well, you had to have... You remember, you had to pull off two. Mm-hmm. You had to pull off two to get the jumper off. If you had the wrong jumper, it wouldn't fit on there. Now, that was nicely designed. Take my...
Speaking of design, did you run into... You know, DuPont designed the building before they even knew, understood completely how it was going to be used. Did it work out well by the time you were there? Was the building performing as...
Oh, yeah. It was performing like the C manual says it should.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, when we did the trial, you know, the speed runs, I think top management was absolutely flabbergasted that that thing was capable of doing that kind of production. Never didn't think it was possible, and that happened in 52 when they just before they went down. I think they shut down in August of 52. I'm not sure when it went down. You look it up someplace. It's around somewhere. Oh, you've got everything here. You've got tank farms.
Well, yeah,
you've got the whole 2S area.
The tech manual has tons of great. It's almost written for a layman in the sense that it's not full of acronyms and utterly technical terminology.
It was written by DuPont people who were chemists and chemical engineers. And this is how they would write a manual for their own things.
It's very readable.
Oh, it's real readable. I mean, if I could read it, it was readable. So, but
what was the last 6 months before they shut the plant down? They were just processing up to the last day, or what kind of things were you doing?
We processed up to the last week, 2 weeks, and then we cleaned for 2 weeks.
What type? You know, how?
Run solutions dummies. Didn't
just to flush things out.
Yep, just flushed everything out. This is when we found out that a couple of the tanks hit some heels, because see, these tanks should have gotten fairly clean. They didn't. They turned out to be pretty hot.
And was it the problem that it was hot, or that you were leaving?
It was higher gamma levels. See, we thought that after we flushed, we could go down to the 6-3 tank, basically, and literally go into the canyon building, and it, you know, get what I'm trying to say?
And walk around.
Walk around, because what the hell, you clean it all up. So, but that didn't really happen that way.
Did they end up just yanking it and burying it?
I thought they left it in for a zillion years and then was pulled out when they decommissioned it.
Because they had no immediate use for the building, right?
Well, but you didn't. Just because we didn't operate with it didn't mean we couldn't.
Right.
And there's nothing says if Purex or a redox doesn't blow up, we didn't know.
Yeah. But you wanted to keep the building operational.
It was in mothballs.
Yeah.
And B plant went off of mothballs. Once we got T plant running high speed, then we didn't need B plant anymore, because now it was doing more than the two plants were doing together. Because before, the two plants were doing 30, we were to 56. So, you know, you said, well, we don't need B plant. So even B plant then went, and we were starting to process the waste solution and taking out strontium. And we were... See, there are only two really bad actors in the waste solution, which would mean that the waste tanks, if you took those out, after about 15, 20 years, would be nothing in them. Mm. And that's cobalt and strontium. If you pull those two babies out, then your tanks would decay to zero, basically, in 15 years. And that was the goal behind some of this. Some of those tanks, they wanted them to be cold. And they were. Though after they had gone through B plant, some of those old tanks, really and truthfully, I mean, you know, you had to literally stuff the CP into it before you could even get a reading. So it worked. It worked. And they were shipping solutions between West Area and B plant, and from B plant back to West Area. There's a pipeline that runs from the tank farms and from B plant to both all the tank farms.
So they could move stuff around?
Yeah, they moved stuff. One of the pipes had hot solution coming in, and the other one was a cold solution going out. Well, let me see. There were three plants built originally to do the same thing, T, B, and U. U plant never went online. And the only thing we did with U plant was we took, and they separated out the uranium from the waste solution. Mm-hmm. And that ran through U plant, and then our product there was yellow cake. You know, it's yellow powder, uranium oxide. And that was shipped wherever, back east, primarily, I think, to Oak Ridge.
Did that lower the tank levels much?
I don't think so. The only thing that would lower the tank levels, basically, would be for evaporation.
Getting rid of
liquid, because once you got rid of the uranium, now you got rid of 59, you know, you got 5,000 gallons, you got 500 gallons, and you pull out almost most of the weight, what's left is either bismuth and lanthanum, plus the fission product, plus the aluminum, the slug can. That was there.
Is that still there?
It's still there.
They never did retrieve
aluminum? Never retrieved a dime of that. There were a lot of proposals put together in the late 50s for mining the bismuth.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it worth that much?
Well, it wasn't worth enough at that time.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever been revisited. You know, there's been so much anti-nuclear things that trying to recover anything, people would be so damn scared that there was a 10 counts per minute of fission products in the bismuth, why they would be upset. So
how about just giving a brief idea of what you did after you left E-plant?
Oh, I went 231 and 2345.
Yeah. More chemistry?
For a year I did chemistry, and then after that I went in radiation protection. And since I had spent so much time in T-231, 2345, I was brought back for the health physics people to 231, 2345. And all of the material that left that building, I signed off on it from 1954.
Signed off in what way?
Signed off. I knew it went out, what the numbers were, that it wasn't contaminated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What containers it was put into when it left the building. Mm-hmm. Who took it?
Okay.
All, and as far as I know, those records are all gone. That was GE. So you wouldn't know. From those, you could make some real quick assumptions as to what went on. But from 1954 to 1958, that was 2345. That's when we went from what we call the rubber glove line, which was hood operation with glove, to a mechanical line, where everything was fairly mechanicalized with that, with little trains, you know, where you didn't touch the material as much. Because when I first got there in 54, the operators in 2345 building were burning out. In other words, they weren't able to work a year. So we had to have operators, you know, not necessarily working 2345 building, but it had to be trained, and then they were rotated. Some of the guys were burning out, and they're getting the limit of radiation that they were allowed by, say, August. So there was 5 or 6 months when you had to bring in other guys. And so it was economically feasible for us to figure out ways in which we could stop doing that. And it wasn't until like 58 before we really solved all the problems and were allowing the operators to run the whole year. So we were able to cut down we cut the exposure more than half so that they could operate the whole year. So. Also, too, remember, 2345 building was top secret.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got fussy about having so many people having top secret.
Oh, I mean, just to work there?
Yeah, just to work there. Because that was final finish plant, see? And so the people who were working there saw what the hell it was, our products, you know? And you just, you know, operators, they weren't just dime a dozen. There was a lot of training besides. I spent a lot of training time, both health physics people as well as operators, because, you know, a guy can't just come in there and It's a foundry. Right. And foundry operations are notoriously famous for, you know, doing all kinds of dumb things. You know, and plutonium was no exception. You know, I mean, if you could do it with lead, you could do it with plutonium, you know, and we did it. And so there was a foundry operation. It's the best description I can give you. I won't say any more than that, because I don't know if it's been declassified.
I don't think, it would take a while for you to find out.
I'd have to go out and take a look at the pictures and see what's been declassified. So I think the only thing that's not declassified anymore is the actual production numbers.
They don't like to talk about that.
And they don't want you talking about that. And they didn't want you talking about too many details about how the line worked. There were lots of problems. You know, since you've got a foundry, there's crucibles in which you were melting the plutonium and it was running down into the shape. Crucibles break. How do you stop that? For a while there we were getting crucibles. See, we never made our crucibles here. We got them. Mm-hmm. And crucible breaking problems were really severe. So that had to be solved. That was not my problem. My problem was making sure the guys weren't getting too much radiation. It was the only operational building which wasn't monitored by operation monitors. We used radiological science people, at least in my tenure there, the 4 years. Then after I left that, one of my major problems was that we knew that the radiation that the people were being exposed to wasn't being properly monitored with a badge. Neutrons are very difficult to monitor, and we were not doing too good.
Film badge doesn't pick up neutrons. That's not meant for neutrons.
It wasn't meant for neutrons, so you would have had to have something separate.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, we went to the new badge, the new film badge, I think in 65, then I went to U.S. Testing, who then had the contract for processing the film badges, the bioassays, and the environmental samples. And we made further improvements. We did a lot of improving. And the last function that I did before I retired from 1989 was to 1995, put the new dosimeter in place, which measures everything.
How do you measure neutrons?
Lithium-6.
Oh, just film impregnated with it?
No, these are little squares, little crystals. Okay. Lithium-6 will store the neutron effect, and when you heat it up, it gives it off as light.
Okay.
And we measure that with a photomultiplier tube. Okay. And same way with a lithium-7, it only measures gamma. Lithium-6 measures gamma and neutrons. And what you're doing is it's only thermal neutrons that you're measuring, but you're measuring the fast neutrons that hit the body, get moderated, and come back. Because
okay.
There ain't no way in hell you're going to measure fast neutrons. Not with anything that I know. Not counters you can do it, but even then they use moderators, you know, like BF3 tubes inside of paraffin casks. Very difficult to measure fast neutrons. And secondly, responses for the BF3 tubes change by a factor of 1,000 between fast and thermal. So you have all these funny little things going on. On film, to go from the old badge, you know, the one that had the silver, to the one with 4 filters, I collected 8,000 data points to get the equations for that thing to work. And then when I did the new badge, I collected, I think, 12,000 data points to make sure that my responses and the equations that I've got in the system are correct. So it wasn't done just haphazardly. It was done with a lot of finesse. We had a lot of statistics. We tried to make the equations be within 95% accuracy. We felt we wanted to move away from 50%.
You said you'd retired what year?
95.
And Hanford had stopped production in 89.
Well, they started back up. We there was a whole bunch of material that NREactor produced. And so it had been sitting there for years and years and years, and so they started PureX back up and got rid of all that.
So what kind of things were you doing the last 5 years when there was no longer production?
2, 3, 4, 5 building didn't go away.
Still had things, yeah, still had material to work with.
Do you know anything about a weapon?
No. Laypersons?
All right, what does a layperson think about a nuclear bomb, atomic bomb? When we make one, does it stay an atomic bomb forever? It doesn't decay, it doesn't get, you know. It turns out if you make an atomic bomb today, that in about 7 years, if you don't do anything with it, it ain't going to work.
And are we talking the plutonium aspect of it? Or the high explosives and all the...
No, the high explosives, not the... What happens, what is in plutonium that could possibly screw up an atom bomb?
Isotopes and oxidation.
Ah, not oxidation.
They took care of that.
That's not, it's the isotopes. And 240 and 241 decay at a pretty quick rate. And it goes to americium, which is a neutron absorber. It's a real suck-up device. Pretty soon you got enough americium sitting there that thing won't go off. It's absorbing the neutrons to where the neutron no longer, you don't have a certain level of neutrons to start the reaction.
Okay.
All right.
So rebuilding.
So you got to take the darn thing apart, get rid of the americium.
Which is a chemical process.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to get rid of the americium and then just make it back into a... Okay, so there's has to be a cycle. So when America and are going on to this non-nuclear and they're not reworking anything, pretty soon you don't have a nuclear capability. So nuclear rework has to be done.
Why wouldn't it have been worthwhile to take the plutonium from Hanford and run it through what they were doing at Oak Ridge with uranium to strip out the isotopes they didn't want and leave pure...
Uranium 235 and 238 is three atoms difference.
Right.
What's plutonium in 239, 240? One.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a diffusion plant that's about 1,000 times bigger than the one you got.
1 to 10 times longer. Yeah. Okay.
You know, you're not going to get the separation you think you're.
Yeah.
However, there is something that's much better. I think it's classified.
But those are problems people thought about.
We thought about that right from the beginning, but...
Does 240 and 241 fission like 239? Is it okay to be in there as far
as... Oh, it's marvelous.
Yeah, okay.
It's marvelous.
It's the decay that's a problem.
Yeah, it goes in and it decays over to americium, and that's where the thing...
Okay.
It's because 240, I think, and 241 are beta emitters, and so they go higher, they go up to americium. And americium is a real absorber. It just loves neutrons. And so next thing you know, all the neutrons are being absorbed by the impurity. Let me see if I can tell you. Exxon did a research. And the guy that did it was Charlie Lindemeyer. He was my physics teacher. And he worked with lasers, and I worked, when I took the class, we solved the problem for him. What kind of stability do you have to have when you're trying to separate with a laser 239 from 240? I won't go any further than that.
Using a laser to do it.
Yes. Laser right now can separate uranium 238 from 235.
By doing what? What effect would a laser have on an isotope? It's just light. They absorb heat differently or something?
They vibrate differently.
Yeah, okay. All right.
They vibrate with a different frequency. And when they vibrate with a different frequency, if you can make one vibrate in one direction and the other one not, then you can pull them babies out. It's a gas laser. I'll let you read up on that. Because I knew what it took. And like I said, you know, early years of computer were not very good because it only had like 6 to 8 digits of accuracy. Not the kind of thing that laser needed. Laser needed much more accuracy. And there is that out there. And also, too, stability of a system. You know, people talk about 0.01%. What the hell? That's only 99.9. When you need 10 digits of accuracy, what the hell is 0.01%? It's peanuts. So you had to work out some other details. Charlie did all that. And we got him started when we were doing a class. Introduction to Mathematical Physics, I can tell you that much.
So that was your own site?
Yeah, that was class. I went to school at nights from 1959 to 1967. See, I was very short on physics and math. I'd only had up to differential equations, which is still a lot more because most of the guys who graduated with a BS in mathematics only had up to differential equations. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't nearly enough for the kind of things that they needed, the kind of accuracy. And the early computers just didn't have the capability either.
But since the process was evolving all the time, I guess that taking classes and learning was sort of almost...
Was a must. Was absolute must, yeah. Since I didn't know any physics, I had to learn physics. I had to learn nuclear engineering. I had to take atomic physics, nuclear physics. I'd take some... Yeah, but most of it was math. I was taking statistics, variables, introduction to mathematical physics. My physics class in college was freshman physics, you know, wedges and inclined planes. I didn't do any good out here. Even a second year level of physics, you know, wouldn't have been enough for the kind of things that we were doing. Atomic physics in particular was...
But you started again in
51.
This place had only been running for, call it, 6, 7 years.
Yeah, and it was...
A brand new industry.
Oh, yeah. We were just beginning. In the area of health physics in particular, we were just beginning. How do you monitor? What can go wrong? Hell, we were learning as we were working. You know, there wasn't, I mean, now, yeah, people scream when we had things happen today, but then after all, we've got 40, 50 years worth of experience. We don't have to have that happen anymore. We wouldn't expect it to happen. But then, that was not the case then. Then it was, you know, we hadn't done very much in the first place, so we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. You know, like pipes breaking, you name it. Glassware where there shouldn't have been glassware, you know, in the system. Buckets when there shouldn't have been buckets. We didn't know anything about criticality. What's the criticality volume or mass for different solutions, different volumetrics, different...
Which might not be a straight line, right?
That's right. Right.
Sample experiment.
See, like maybe anything that's 4 inches in diameter, no matter how you fill it, it's never going to go critical. But you make it 6 inch, and boy, you only got to get about 2-3 inches, and it goes critical. Little things like that, that was not known. Those experiments were being run out here. We call mass criticality laboratory. That was, and I was responsible for all of the early work that was going on, especially in the solutions.
Really?
Yeah. Ed Duane Clayton was the guy that was leading that, but we were doing the monitoring on him. And we were trying to figure out how to monitor his neutrons and his radiation, so...
For health reasons.
Yeah, for saving him. We didn't want that guy getting hurt. You know, and these guys didn't know whether they were going to have an explosion or not explosion. They, you know, they were working. Yeah, they blew up a lab.
That was the famous criticality?
Yeah. The old farmhouse over in F area. Well, you read about a criticality down in Los Alamos, where the guy was nudging two pieces together.
That was the earliest one, right?
Yeah, that was two metal pieces. But we've had two criticality situations, 1 and 2, 3, 4, 5 building, where we had an operation failure, and the solution dripped into a bucket,
collected.
In a 3-gallon bucket.
Yeah.
and not critically safe.
And the bucket was there just to catch drips?
No. Shouldn't have been there.
What were the drips going to go into otherwise?
Should have been a criticality safety container.
Oh. But they put a bucket there to catch drips.
Yeah. Shouldn't have been. Shouldn't have been. Should have been a 4-inch diameter container instead of a...
Yeah.
It's one of those oversights.
And a perfectly vivid illustration of what the deal is.
You're right. What happens, because we knew what could happen if it did, and it did happen. And it went critical several times over a period of many months. And I spent swing shift out there for weeks. We never came home.
Really?
Yeah. It happened in our building. It didn't happen with my operation, you know, but we supplied the monitoring people, making sure everything was still safe. You got 2, 3, 4, 5 building, my God, you got to think about what the hell was out there. And we couldn't go in there and clean it up, you know. I mean, there was, the line was was left with all that stuff, and no one knew whether if you had something go critical over here, would it set up ringing effects all over there and all that kind of stuff. Because after all, you got material laying around. You might be in the critical safe configuration, but now all of a sudden what happens when it... Yeah, now you got a big level of neutrons. It's one thing to have, say, 10 to the 6 neutrons. It's a whole other thing to have 10 to the 18th. You know, I want that answer right now, quick, from some nuclear physicist.
Yeah.
And that wasn't that fast in coming.
Yeah, that's a very complicated situation.
Yeah, the guy had they had to sit down and work. It was... And they didn't have an answer right away. That's why we didn't do anything for quite a while. We were scared to have anybody close to the building because of the... Am I making any sense to you?
Oh, yeah.
See, that's what I say. Nowadays, now that we know all that, you know, you wouldn't do that. So the probability...
In any industry, you have to collect a certain amount of work experience.
Right.
To get to a certain level of expertise.
Right.
And you're doing it at the beginning, but 20 years later, when you look back, say, my God, how did we get anything done back then?
Well, you wouldn't, but you didn't have the safety rules, and you know, you went in there and you went at it. All I can say is, we were very strong in monitoring. When we saw something that wasn't quite what we thought scope was headed, we shut it down and discussed it with management and operations people. And if it didn't suit us, we kept it shut down until top management made the decision. That happened several times.
I presume any time you quote shut something down,
you got a lot of static. Yeah. You know, you got a lot of operating managers. You know, I go straight up to the top management real quick. Like, health physics was one guy, and here's operations over here.
Yeah.
And when you're shutting those guys down, you know. Now, the only guy that can really settle the arc is the guy above both of them. And so it went there really quick because time is money.
Yeah. Or national defense.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the overriding
premise. That was the major premise at that time. I don't think...
Pick up your headlines in the morning.
Right. Well, in the days when we were operating, we didn't make a big to-do about the kinds of levels that they're making a big to-do now. 1,000 comp per minute level. Now is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't think it was a big deal until it got 10,000. But then when you're mucking around in zillions,
right.
What's 10,000? See, but nothing going on, it's a whole different thing. Everything's been cleaned up. I can see where 1,000 is meaningful because that's something you can see. Also, too, in some of the areas, you couldn't see 1,000 counts.
They weren't measuring that low.
Well, you had too much background. I mean, you go in that canyon building, there isn't hardly any place that you could get that wasn't reading 500 counts per minute, period. Especially when you open the cell blocks. 6-3 cell blocks?
Mm-hmm.
That whole area, you had to set the five folds for 500, basically. So it was or you always wanted to be sure you got the cell blocks back on during shift change. Because when people are going out and in.
Out and in of the canyon?
Canyon. Well, where there's shift change. So when you go out of the canyon, you have to go through the fivefold. And when you come in, you go through the fivefold. You know, I make sure you're clean to come in, and I make sure you're clean going out. So 99.9% of the time, the cell blocks were on top of the cells at shift change. Because it wasn't true, because, you know, I hate to say it, but there was, you know, mega rads coming out of a cell, you know, and that's coming up and hitting that ceiling.
As a layperson, that's what I still don't have a feeling for. If somebody could show me what the canyon looked like when you took a lid off using light instead of vague numbers.
All right, shoot a beam up 20 feet. And what's it going to do when it hits that top?
Right.
It's going to scatter.
But if I think of a flashlight, like, so what? But you're talking about a big streak, like a light they'd use in front of a used car lot at night, right?
Oh, go that by about 100,000.
Yeah, and that's what I can't visualize.
Okay, a lifetime dose per year was 3 rem. Mm-hmm. Suppose I've got 1,000 mega rads. How long would it take me to get 3 rads? Not very damn long, because everything was measured in rads per hour.
And the dissolver full of
dissolver solution
of uranium
read in mega rads.
Yeah.
To give you an example, a doorstop, 2 drops,
right,
with a CP off scale, that's 5 rads, TP 20 rads.
Okay, how long could you be near that to pick up your 3 rads then?
Ah, but I was only allowed to pick up 0.05.
Per day?
Per week.
So how long does that take?
Well, take 0.05, you know, rads total, and then say you're going to now, you've got, I need a piece of paper and pencil. Suppose you got 1 rad.
You want these paper pencils?
Okay. 1 rad per hour.
Okay, it's per hour.
Right, it's always per hour.
That's a
rate. It's always a rate. And now you're going to receive in a certain, you're going to measure that by time. T times 1 hour per hour is equal to 0.05, because these cancel.
Mm-hmm.
So what does, say, take one underneath 0.05. So one time is equal to 0.05 over 1 R, which is what, 20? 1/20. 1/20. 1/20 of an hour.
3 minutes.
Yes.
From 2 drops.
Yeah.
So if you screwed around in the lab, you might have to leave work for the rest of the week if you were.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And it might only take you 3 minutes to get it. They were really pissed off at you if you worked 3 minutes a week.
Right.
Am I making any sense to you?
So if you were in the canyon at the far end of the canyon, you know, down there, and they took the lid off of the dissolver cell, you'd be getting a big dose.
Yeah, about 5 rem per hour. Probably could be done in there, maybe about 30 seconds, and then you'd have enough for the week. Well, we allowed people to get a maximum of 50 millirem per day, 250 millirem per week. But if you got 250 millirem per week, you only allowed 3 rem, so that would be 12 weeks worth of work. So we didn't try to let anybody get 250 millirem a week. So we were trying to keep them down at 50, because 50 times 52 is 2.5, is 2.6. That's as far as we wanted them to go. So we were trying to, if he got 50, then, you know, if he got 30 minutes, he had 39.5 hours a week that he couldn't do anything. That was not very efficient.
No. Two things I always like to ask. If the whole process in the canyons wasn't radioactive, it was just chemical, how big of a plant would it have been? You want to process the same amount of material.
Not bigger than my house.
Okay. And workers could go around and tune it up and look at gauges, take samples. All the chemistry would have been the same.
Yeah.
But forget it would have been a very straightforward chemical.
Oh, God. All that pipery that you see, that would have all disappeared. Because you'd have gone in there and poured the old solutions with a bucket. And would have been, it would have looked more like a laboratory.
Okay.
You know, what's 500 gallons? At that end, it's 500 gallons, and on that end, it's 15, you know.
So the whole, the massive size of that building, all it said was, this stuff is radioactive.
Right. Now, had they built the building a little bit thinner, we could have had nothing but super problems.
Nothing but what?
Super problems.
Okay.
Suppose they had, do you know anything about a half-value layer?
Half-value
layer.
No.
A half-value layer is a thickness of material which, when you put a source on this side, will, if I say I'm at 3 feet and I get a reading of 1, now I put a certain amount of material in between the source, you know, such that it now reduces it to 0.5. Okay, that's a half-value layer.
Okay.
Okay,
right.
If I put 2 half-value layers on there, I get a quarter.
You don't get 0. Right?
No, I get a quarter. So 3 half-value layers. Okay, so I got megarads, and I got to have it down to less than a millirad. So you're talking about 10 to the ninth. Well, how many half-value layers do you have to have to have 10 to the ninth? Okay. If you miss it by very many half-value layers, and you don't have to miss it by much, like, for instance, if it was 1 millirad now per hour, and it couldn't be that high because he could only work 40 hours a week, and if 40 would have burned out. So they were guesstimating what it would take, and they put 15 feet. Had they put, say, 12 feet, we would have had we would have had to put up lead walls, et cetera, on the inside.
And nobody ever had to do that.
They hadn't done that before. Hadn't done that before. And so, was 15 feet okay? So, what little we knew about nuclear, about absorption, those guys did a good job.
How could they estimate what that, a full-blown 1.5, 1,500 pounds of uranium, they guessed at what the radiation would be, you know, educated guess.
Yeah, and then they put a factor of 10 safety.
Yeah.
And that's about what they did. And thank God they did, because even at that, we were getting radiation at the pipe gallery and at the operating level.
If you went to the wall.
Where they were operating, where they were moving the dials.
They were getting
radiation doses.
Coming through.
Yes, yes.
And they were above it, too.
And that was going through the shielding. It's those little things that really lead you to believe that it was, God, it was magnificent. In other words, DuPont did a great job.